What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
We are going to talk today about something you may have learned about in school that you may have learned about wrongly. And that is Chief Seattle and a very famous oration that he made, allegedly, in 1854. Except probably not.
The reality is a little different from what people are usually taught.
Very true. So Chief Seattle really was a real person. He was chief of the Suquamish and other related tribes around the area now known as Seattle through the mid-1800s when settlers were moving into the area. And what many people remember him for, in addition to the city of Seattle being named after him, is a speech that he gave. Although many versions of the speech that circulate are absolutely not by him at all. We will talk a little bit more about that in just a bit.
So, for a little bit of background about the Suquamish people, Suquamish, which is an Americanized pronunciation of their name, actually means a place of clear salt water.
And they and other nearby tribes were primarily fishers, hunters, and gatherers. At the time before American settlement of that part of the world, they lived in cedar plank longhouses in the winter. And then in the rest of the year, they would travel around using dugout cedar canoes and stay in temporary camps that were made of structures made from tree saplings that were covered with mats made of woven cattail.
And they also were really well known for making these hard, watertight baskets from coiled cedar roots. And they could actually use these baskets for cooking. They would heat rocks up in the fire and drop them into liquid-filled baskets to create a very heated water source.
Yes.
Which they could then drop other things into and cook them.
Yes. This is a tribe that still exists today. It has about 950 members, and about half of those members live on a reservation up in the Pacific Northwest. The most notable famous person from this tribe is Chief Seattle, and that also is an Americanized pronunciation. Like many non-English names, it includes characters and phonemes that don't exist in English. An approximation of the actual pronunciation of it is Seat, and we don't really end words with T in that way. And so it sort of gradually became softened to Seattle. According to the Suquamish Foundation, the tribe doesn't really object to him being called Seattle, although he did himself have some misgivings about the city being named for him at various points in his life. He's sort of worried that because of the importance of names in his culture, that having people repeatedly use his name in a context that was not about him in kind of a casual, possibly dismissive way, might cause problems after he was gone. But before his death, reportedly he had come to think of it as a mark of honor.
Now, we don't know a whole lot about Seattle's early years, because he doesn't really appear in the historical record until he's an adult.
Right. There are a few official and tribal records from various points in his life. A lot of the earliest part, you have really a lot of different sources that contradict each other. Even when you look at tribal sources, some of them contradict each other. By his own account, he was born on Blake Island in central Puget Sound, and his mother was named Sholitza. She was a Duwamish woman from Green River, and his father was Shwiabe from the Suquamish village in Agate Pass. So he had a mother who was Duwamish and a father who was Suquamish, and so his bloodline sort of united those two tribes. When he was born, it was a time when huge amounts of illness were spreading through the Native American population. About 30% of the population in that area died within 80 years after first contact with the white settlers because of introduced diseases.
And by Seattle's own account, he witnessed the first contact between the Pacific Northwest and settlers when George Vancouver reached Bainbridge Island in 1792 in the HMS Discovery.
Yes. Seattle had two important events that led to his becoming chief. The first was that he went on a vision quest for spirit power as a youth, and he received Thunderbird power. Thunder and lightning had a really strong spiritual significance, and thunder power was said to give a person power as a warrior and a speaker. There are accounts of Seattle saying that he had a great booming voice, and that if he yelled at you, the ground would physically tremble. And that when he gave speeches, he could be heard like half a mile away. Like, there was a lot tied to him, this idea of voice and speech and very powerful speech.
And the second other thing that is an important part of the story of him becoming chief is that while defending a settlement from raiders traveling down the White River, he had warriors chop down trees just downriver of a particularly dangerous bend. And the incoming raiders' canoes crashed and they couldn't get through. So their riders were spilled into the water. And it's fairly easy to defend yourself against people who are floundering in the water.
Yes.
Versus coming at you rapidly on boats.
Right. The incoming raiders were handily dispatched when they came around this like treacherous curve and crashed into a tree.
Which is pretty ingenious.
Right. Word spread of that. He was named to be an important chief. And he became known in his leadership as an intelligent and formidable leader. There are several sources that say that he owned slaves who he either freed after signing treaties with the settlers or after the Emancipation Proclamation. Their sources kind of contradict each other on when he's freed the slaves that belong to him. But owning slaves is a pretty common practice in many tribes. Often people from the opposing tribe would kind of be spoils of war and would become the slaves of the conquering tribe.
Which is pretty common throughout all history and
yeah.
many cultures.
Yeah, I think some people have the mistaken idea that there's only one culture that enslaved other people, and there are many cultures that have enslaved other people.
But on to his wives. So his first wife, Ladelia, he was really quite deeply in love with, and she died shortly after giving birth to their first child, Kiki Soblu. Who was also known to the settlers as Princess Angeline.
Yes, she's a notable historical figure in that area as well. Seattle was really grief-stricken when his wife died, and he only talked about her openly much, much later in his later years. He got married again to, and I am going to have trouble with this pronunciation, Yoyail, and they had two daughters and three sons together.
Now, an interesting part of his story is that he was actually baptized into the Catholic Church. I think sometimes it's easy to forget that there really was some blending of culture going on.
Right.
And after the death of one of his sons was when he was baptized, and he took the name Noah Seattle at that time. And his children were raised in the Catholic faith. And after Seattle's conversion, he focused less on defending and occupying his territory and more on building peaceful relations within the tribe and with the settlers that were coming in.
Right. The American settlers had gotten to the Puget Sound area around 1846, and Seattle established himself from the very start as a welcoming and peaceful presence. He tended to make friends with settlers. He instructed the people in his tribes to try to help people. They established fisheries in conjunction with the settlers. And in particular, he was very close friends with a man named Dr. David S. Maynard, who was known as Doc. Doc Maynard was the first doctor and merchant in Seattle, and he was a prominent person. He owned most of the land that is Pioneer Square in Seattle today.
And the settlement that actually became known as Seattle was established in 1852, which is just 6 short years after the American settlers landed in the Puget Sound area. So in March of 1853, Washington was separated out from the Oregon Territory, and in October, Governor Isaac Stevens, who was 35 at the time, arrived in Olympia, the capital of Washington. In addition to being governor of the territory, he was also the Commissioner of Indian Affairs.
Yes, and one of his jobs as the governor and as the Commissioner for Indian Affairs was to secure land for the Transcontinental Railroad. And that was going to require the local tribes to cede their land to him. So it's in this context that Seattle has met Stevens for the first time, and Stephen wants to secure the land, that Chief Seattle reportedly gave a speech. Allegedly, this was delivered to Stevens, or in the presence of him, on the steps of Doc Maynard's office, after he was introduced to Stevens and heard that Stevens wanted to get the local land from the native population. According to what has been reported, this happened on Stevens' first visit into the town, but that's a little hard to concretely verify, because we only have a few situations in that the history of the area when we know that Seattle and Stevens were in the same place at the same time. So there's been a lot of speculation about when exactly this speech may have taken place.
And it, in many of the accounts where it happened very almost immediately after they met, it's a little bit tricky to get your head around the idea of this great speech being made pretty quickly after like a handshake and a quick discussion.
Right. Yeah. We'll talk about that as we talk about the text of the speech a little bit. This is a speech that some people may have read in school. What they read in school may not have been remotely accurate. And here's why. The first speech was purportedly recorded by a Dr. Henry Smith as notes, as the address was delivered. He then reconstructed that speech from his notes and published it in the Seattle Sunday Star in 1887. So it was 32 or 33 years after it was reportedly delivered. Occasionally, people say that this speech was made at the signing of the Point Elliott Treaty. We know for sure this is not the case, because Smith says pretty specifically this happened in Seattle on the steps of Doc Maynard's office. That is not where the Point Elliott Treaty was signed.
And Smith was also not present at Point Elliott, so no. He would have not been able to make notes.
No. The second version is basically an edited, rewritten version of Smith's that was published in the Seattle Sunday Star, which was done by a poet named William Arrowsmith. This is the same content, but the grammar and structure are different. So it's sort of like updating the Victorian English record to be a little bit more modernized in its tone and voice.
And then the third and most famous iteration of the speech that's attributed to Chief Seattle is reported to be a letter that Chief Seattle wrote to the president, which would have been either Polk or Pierce, depending on who you're looking at in terms of who cites this speech. But it was actually written not at all by Seattle. It was written so much later.
1970s, by a guy named Ted Perry for an environmental film called Home, which was written for the Southern Baptist Convention. A lot of people really dwell on the speech and whether it was authentic. It pretty clearly was not. But this speech has been quoted in numerous anthologies. It was made into a children's book called Brother Eagle, Sister Sky. Joseph Campbell talked about it in The Power of Myth. It's like made it onto bumper stickers and t-shirts all over the place.
It took on a life of its own.
It really did. And it sort of starts with this this thing that was published in the Seattle Sunday Star. It starts with some similarities to that, and then it veers off in a very environmental direction with very bumper sticker quotable quotes in it. we know for sure that this was not a letter to the president. In addition to the fact that James K. Polk was dead in 1854, there's not any record of any such letter going from Seattle to the president. And a letter from a Native American chief to the president would have made several bureaucratic stops on the way, and there's no record of it in any of those places. There's also no record of Chief Seattle asking anyone to write a letter for him. And since he was illiterate, he would have needed to do that.
And then the cherry on top.
Ted Perry wrote it.
And he says he wrote
he it. Says he wrote it.
He acknowledges authorship of it.
Right. So I'm going to take a minute and just sort of read a little snippet of the Seattle Sunday Star version and the Ted Perry version. And there's a twofold purpose here. One is to give you an idea of the tone of the speech that was allegedly given originally. And the other is to give you an idea of how completely different from that the Ted Perry version is. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the Sunday Star version in a minute. So this is a snippet from the Seattle Sunday Star version. Chief Seattle says, "Your God is not our God. Your God loves your people and hates mine. He folds his strong protecting arms lovingly about the pale face and leads him by the hand as a father leads an infant son. But he has forsaken his red children, if they are really his. Our God, the Great Spirit, seems also to have forsaken us. Your God makes your people wax stronger every day. Soon they will fill all the land. Our people are ebbing away like a rapidly receding tide that will never return. The white man's God cannot love our people, or he would protect them. They seem to be orphans who can look nowhere for help. How, then, can we be brothers? It's very sad."
It is. But it's also very weird when you remember that he was a Catholic.
Yes. It's weird with a lot of context that we'll talk about in more detail. The whole of it has been categorized into this idea of a farewell speech. There are several speeches delivered by Native Americans within that era that sort of lament the death of Native American culture in the face of white settlement. Another really famous one would be Chief Joseph gave such an address. We'll talk a little bit more about why that interpretation of this is kind of problematic in a few minutes, but here's a piece of the Ted Perry version. And it does start off following some similar points to what I just read, but then it goes into this environmental direction with things like, "You must teach your children that the ground beneath their feet is the ashes of our grandfathers, so that they will respect the land. Tell your children that the earth is rich with the lives of our kin. Teach your children that what we will have taught our children, that the earth is our mother. Whatever befalls the earth, befalls the sons of the earth. If men spit upon the ground, they spit upon themselves. This we know. The earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. This we know. All things are connected, like the blood which unites one family. All things are connected. Whatever befalls the earth, befalls the sons of the earth. Man did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself." That has two bits of it that often show up on T-shirts and bumper stickers and that kind of thing.
Well, and it's easy to see why. I mean, it is very moving and, you know, really
quotable,
very quotable, sort of poignant from an ecological standpoint, which I think part of the reason that myth grows and, you know, continues this attribution of these words with Chief Seattle is that we normally associate that sort of awareness of the earth and the planet as something bigger than just what we're, you know, sort of running on day to day. We associate that closeness more with Native Americans than we do with the European settlers.
Right. It really did take on a weird life of its own. And the reason it's so quotable is because it was written for a film.
It was written to be quotable.
Yes. So I've read lots of things that kind of dissect all the ways in which that particular version of the address does not make any sense in the context of the time. But we're not going to really get into them because we know the real story already that Ted Perry wrote it. Like, we don't really need to go and dissect all the ways in which it would not make sense for Chief Seattle to have said something about trains when he never saw a train, because we know that Ted Perry wrote it. So for the rest of this podcast, the version of the address that we're talking about is the one that was printed in the Seattle Sunday Star.
It was reprinted many times throughout the years.
It was reprinted. Not as many times as the Ted Perry version, but it got its share of attention. At various points, that text was reprinted in pamphlets and books and histories and things like that. At some point along the line, somebody added a 13-word finish. He ends with the idea of not to dismiss the dead because the dead are not powerless. And somebody added a sort of 13-word coda that says, "Dead, I say? No, there is no death, only a change of worlds." And that's not in the original Sunday Star version. So that got added in and then sort of picked up and passed along as it was reprinted. We're going to sort of talk now about how even when we have this text that came from the Seattle Sunday Star, we're still not really sure how authentic it is or how well it actually represents the words that were spoken at the time. And it begins with the guy who wrote it down. Dr. Henry Smith was a scholar, and sources said that he was bilingual in English and Duwamish. And that is a little weird, because what the Duwamish tribes actually spoke was a language called Lushootseed. I apologize if I have pronounced that wrongly. Any address that Chief Seattle gave would have been made in this language and then translated to the Chinook jargon, which was sort of a common tongue uniting all of the people that lived in that area. Then it would have been translated into English. We don't really know which of the versions Dr. Smith was listening to when he took his notes. And it is worth noting that the fact that Seattle either didn't speak the jargon or said he didn't speak the jargon kind of sets him apart from other people in the area. Like, that's kind of a weird decision to make, to say, I don't speak this common tongue.
I lead all of these tribes who speak a language I do not.
Right. But that meant that he had to have an interpreter everywhere, which sort of became a mark of status. Like, if we are going to entertain this diplomat from these tribes, we're going to need to make sure that we do this thing of getting an interpreter for him. So we don't really know which of these three versions that were probably being delivered was the one that Dr. Smith took his notes from.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road trip or waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
And we do know, I mean, he is a fairly reliable figure in that he was a superintendent of local schools. He was a member of the legislature. So it's not like he was just a self-proclaimed scholar who swooped in and claimed to understand these things. He really was pretty ingrained in the area. He wasn't just someone claiming to be knowledgeable about these things. He was an established part of the community.
Right. The place where it gets a little weird, though, is that the column in the Sunday Star where he published this speech, in addition to it being 32 or 33 years after the fact, was part of an 11-part series that was celebrating the pioneers of Seattle. It was, as we often see generational divides happening, there was this generational divide happening between the people known as the Old Seattle, which were the pioneers that had settled the area and established the city, and New Seattle, which was the young entrepreneurs who were gradually taking those people's places in society. So the fact that he was trying to put Old Seattle in its best light might have influenced the way Smith reinterpreted and reconstructed his notes when he was making the version that he put in the Seattle Sunday Star.
And even his description of Seattle at the address kind of exemplifies this. He describes the chief as putting his hand on the head of a visible nobleman and then taking up a posture that resembles what we think of in ancient Roman senators.
Yeah, like if you look at old pictures of people giving orations, like paintings of people giving orations in Rome, and they have this very noble bearing and they have sort of a hand lifted up, that's the portrait that Smith paints when he's introducing this speech. It definitely comes off as prophetic because it talks a lot about the decline of the Native American population in the face of white settlers. It's possible that the reason that it comes off as prophetic is because Smith reconstructed it with knowledge of what happened in the next 30 years, which really was an orchestrated attempt by the government in lots of places to push Native Americans out of land and to break up tribes so that their original culture would be less prevalent or just removed from their way of life. Like he knew about all that stuff.
Because it had happened in the interim.
Right, it had happened in the interim. Another thing that had happened in the interim was what we mentioned a little earlier, which was Chief Joseph's sort of farewell speech. That happened in 1877. So it's possible that some of the fatalism in the tone is influenced by Smith's knowledge of what happened later and of the kind of speeches that other Native Americans were making elsewhere in the United States.
And additionally, we should note that Seattle already had a reputation for being really friendly and welcoming to the white settlers that were coming long before Governor Stevens' arrival. So it's pretty uncharacteristic that he would suddenly have this sort of negative, very dark speech.
Right.
It was full of pessimism and warning.
Yeah, it's a sense of impending doom, but he had a pretty favorable relationship with a lot of white settlers in the area. So it seems that he may have been concerned about land being removed from his tribe, but the overwhelming sense of sadness seems possibly not characteristic of his other encounters with white settlers.
And there's also no record of this speech in the Smithsonian. It's not in the National Archives. It's not in the Library of Congress.
Yeah, the primary source that we have is something that was written down
in note form.
Starting in note form more than 30 years after the fact. We do, though, have, as a reference, two short speeches that Seattle made at the Point Elliott Treaty Council, which was from December 25th to 27th, 1854. And these are from the record of the proceedings in the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the National Archives. They are so dissimilar in style and wording to the Seattle Sunday Star piece. they're so different, I can read you both of them, which I'm going to do. The first is, I look upon you as my father. I and the rest regard you as such. All of the Indians have the same good feeling toward you, and will send it in paper to the great father. All of the men, old men, women, and children rejoice that he has sent you to take care of them. My mind is like yours. I don't want to say more. My heart is very good towards Dr. Maynard. I want always to get medicine from him. That's thing one. The other is presumably after the treaty was signed. And he says, now by this we make friends and put away all bad feelings, if ever we had any. We are the friends of the Americans. All the Indians are of the same mind. We look upon you as our father. We will never change our minds, but since you have been to see us, we will always be the same. Now do you send this paper? So vastly different in tone from this other address that was supposedly delivered, you know, within a year or so of this. We could get into things that are kind of trouble, like the deferential tone that people might think is troubling in this particular set of addresses, but I more am interested in looking at how that sounds so much different from this thing that was allegedly delivered on Doc Maynard's office steps.
Yes, and several people that were supposedly there had no memory of such an address that was that long or impassioned. A local interpreter by the name of B.F. Shaw was there. He didn't remember it. David S. Maynard's widow, Catherine, was there, and she had no recollection of a long, impassioned speech. And there aren't any other contemporary records of Seattle delivering any speeches like it. You know, the newspaper in Olympia did not report any similar things. There's really no historical record of speeches of that nature being made by him.
Right. One of the primary chroniclers of the history of the Pacific Northwest from that time is a man named Clarence B. Bagley. He moved with his family to the Pacific Northwest when he was 9. And in addition to working a lot of other jobs, from painting to running mines, he was a newspaper man, and he became like a really prominent local historian. He was part of the founding of the Washington State Historical Society, and he wrote 2 3-volume histories, one of Seattle and one of King County, which is the county that Seattle is in. And both of these are still looked on as achievements in the documenting of the Pacific Northwest history. He mentions more than once in his book that Chief Seattle and Doc Maynard were great friends. And this speech supposedly happened on Doc Maynard's office steps. So it seems sort of odd to many historians today that the friendship between Seattle and Doc Maynard would have been important enough to mention more than once in these histories, but that a speech of that length with that tone would not be. The last thing that kind of makes people question how authentic this recording from the Seattle Sunday Star is that Smith said on his deathbed that the account was true and accurate, which seems a little strange to people, that would be what you'd spend your dying breath reiterating. That thing that I wrote in the Seattle Sunday Star was really a thing that happened.
Yes, especially since there's really no corroborating evidence for it.
Right.
As you said, it's an odd last words scenario.
Yes. The general consensus, I mean, there's a surprising, maybe not surprising, there's a fair amount of debate about lots of aspects of this speech, and the general consensus is probably there was an address of some sort, probably that happened when Chief Seattle was introduced to Governor Stevens, but that probably what we have today as a record of it is not 100% what actually was said. It's not quite feasible for something to be reconstructed from notes 30 years after the fact to be 100% accurate to what had happened at the time.
Well, and it's also important to take into account that we were still early on in our relationship, you know, in terms of Native Americans and the settlers and pioneers coming in. That relationship was still very early.
It was.
So the linguistic development between them, like learning each other's languages, was probably, you know, still in its infancy in many ways. So there were probably lots of nuances of language that were not clear to each side. So in terms of interpretation, there's some gray area.
Right. It continues to be an important address. I think its importance, some of it has to do with this whole backstory of understanding better the context in which it may have happened and the relationships among the people involved. And a lot of that leads into the legacy of Chief Seattle and of this speech. He had a pretty welcoming attitude toward settlers for his entire life, really, and especially his time as chief. And this didn't really make him popular with all of the rest of the Native American population, especially when he signed the Point Elliott Treaty in 1855. That treaty relinquished all of the tribal claims to most of the land in the area. What was supposed to happen was that the tribes would get access to hunting and fishing grounds, health care, education, and a reservation in exchange for doing all of that. That is, as we all know, not really what happened. And it took 3 years for the treaty to be ratified. And by the time it was ratified, it was very different from what people had originally agreed to. So there was a whole lot of unrest among the Native American people. It's pretty telling when you look at historical accounts. A lot of the most mainstream ones talk about how Seattle was always a friend to the settlers and he signed this treaty out of friendship. When you look at tribal records, the tone is more that he was afraid of a military conflict that he knew there was no way to win. So it's something that you can definitely look at from multiple angles, thinking about the relationships between these two people, which from this point was definitely not as positive as it had been in the very earliest days of the founding of Seattle.
Well, and the Native Americans did accuse Seattle of duplicity, and it really led to a lot of ongoing problems, especially because of how the treaty actually played out once it was in effect. There were wars between the Native tribes and the settlers in the mid-1850s.
Yeah, all through those, lots of things, lots of areas of the Pacific Northwest where there were wars between the Native Americans and the settlers. And Seattle continued to remain an ally and tried to keep his tribes out of the battle. In some points, he would warn the American settlers of incoming attacks by other tribes. So he continued to stand by the white settlers, even as a lot of the other Native tribes nearby and the ones that were maybe not part of his particular collection of tribes really fought back against the settlers.
And after the town of Seattle was incorporated, an 1865 ordinance actually forbade permanent Indian houses within the city limits.
Right. So he had to give up his home.
Yeah. Which...
Yeah, they had already,
troubling.
You know, already figuratively there had been of giving up of the homeland, and then he literally had to move out of the city. He moved to the Port Madison Suquamish Reservation, and he died there after a brief illness in June of 1866 at about the age of 80, since we're not completely sure exactly when he was born. That's an estimate. We know that his funeral involved both Catholic and Native rites, but there wasn't a record of it in the newspapers of the time, not really involved in any of the records of the local white settlers. To our knowledge, no leaders who had known him and who had helped found the city with his assistance attended his funeral. So by that point, by the point of his death, he was not well known in the area anymore, at least among the settlers. The Seattle Weekly Intelligencer printed an article about his funeral in 1870, so it was some years after it happened. And then the Seattle Sunday Star with his speech came out in 1887. He started to become a folk hero at that point, and the Ted Perry speech from the 70s made him into more of a household name.
And some history-minded people put up a marker in 1890 that read, "Seattle, Chief of the Suquamps and Allied Tribes, died June 7th, 1866, from Friend of the Whites, and for him the city of Seattle was named by its founders." The reverse side reads, "Baptismal name, Noah Self, age probably 80 years." So there is a marker, but
yes.
It didn't go up for...
It didn't go up until some people decided that there should be one. It was sort of marked with a rough...
Yeah, 24 years later.
Yes, it was roughly marked before that point. The Suquamish tribe opened a museum in Seattle in September of 2012, which is about the tribe's history and culture. Chief Seattle does play a small part in the overall museum, but he's not the center focus of it. The Seattle Times quotes the museum director as saying, "I think the tribe is consciously trying to move away from Chief Seattle being the beginning, middle, and end of the tribe. It's in no way a reflection of less esteem or less respect." It was not there yet the last time I was in Seattle.
Nope.
Now I want to go.
Either. It's quite recent. So, yeah, I want to go too.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to see how history treats him.
Right.
You know, in terms of him having it once been, I mean, I know for me growing up in the 70s, in just outside of Seattle, there was lots of Chief Seattle talk. So it's
yes.
very interesting now to know that in the museum, at least, his role is played down a little bit.
Right. Well, and I can imagine it being, since the city was named after him, growing up in that area, growing up in the Pacific Northwest, I think the people's exposure to Chief Seattle and who he was and what his legacy was and what the Native Americans in the area are like is probably vastly different from much of the rest of the United States.
I would imagine, yes.
Yes.
Having not grown up in the rest of the United States to compare, I do not know.
Well, and I do.
I would guess.
I love Seattle. I think it's an awesome, beautiful part of the world. And I am glad that we have the records that we do have of what the settlement there was like. It is as many parts of American history are when it comes to the relationship between settlers and Native Americans is very distressing, especially when you consider that after the time period that we've talked about, there were some pretty orchestrated efforts by the government to try to basically breed out, in quotes, Native Americans. There was like sending Native American children to boarding schools so that they wouldn't be exposed to their native culture, that type of thing. So the fact that the Suquamish tribe has been able to survive in the face of all that is noted as an achievement, that there are still 950 members after all of that.
Indeed.
I feel like we're ending on a sad note.
I know. I'm trying to think of a way to make it happy, but there's a new museum.
There is a new museum, and the pictures of it look beautiful.
Yeah, gorgeous.
They look really beautiful and like a really wonderful place to go and learn more about cultural history of that part. Anytime you travel in the Pacific Northwest, the Native American influence is just so visible in a lot of places. And so being able to see where that all comes from, instead of it just being sort of the facade stuck on the building,
mm-hmm.
I think is a wonderful thing to be able to do.
Yes. Maybe we should have a pilgrimage.
Let's do.
Let's have a history field trip.
We can visit my brother.
I also have a brother and a sister there.
Yay.
So we're covered.
Yes.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about Comfort Hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
And I believe you also have listener mail.
I certainly do, and this one amuses me a little bit because it is a correction to a correction that we previously read in listener mail. We had previously read a correction about whether you could describe the Pope as having resigned. And so this one comes from Jacqueline, and she says, "Hi, ladies. Just listened to your last podcast, and I wanted to clarify a piece of mail that said the word resign should not be used in regard to Pope Benedict. As a former reporter for a Catholic newspaper, I pulled out my Catholic AP style guide." Yes, we had to use two style guides when writing stories. And the word retirement can be used for a pope, priest, cardinal, or bishop. Here's what it says. Retirement. When referring to a priest, bishop, cardinal, etc., it can be said that he retired from active ministry, or, in the case of a priest, attained senior priest status. This is to clarify the point that a priest does not retire from the priesthood. He remains a priest, though has retired from full-time assignments. So the word retirement or resigned can be used, as it's how it's used that matters to the Catholic Church. Hope this clears things up for everyone. So while that entry does not specifically say Pope, we did go look this up ourselves. After we recorded our previous one where we talked about that correction.
Yeah, because we realized in talking about it that we had seen it on many other news sites listed as resigned rather than renounced.
So we sort of said, what is the rule?
Let's look it up.
And the AP did specifically use the word retired, as did, it turns out, the Vatican. Official things from the Vatican website used the word retired. When Pope Benedict delivered his address, it was translated to the word renounced. So that word can be used. But then also there were official things from the Vatican that used the word resigned. So it appears that resigned is okay as a word to use about talking about a pope stepping down.
It happens so infrequently, and certainly in the modern era.
I know.
That we don't really have a clear established rule.
You don't really have at the top of
your
mind.
That we're used to. Yeah, we don't.
What to call a pope's no longer being the pope. So, yes, if you would like to comment further about when we can and can't use the word resign, or this podcast, or anything else, you may write to us at historypodcast@discovery.com. We're also on Twitter at Missed in History, and on Facebook at facebook.com/historyclassstuff. If you would like to learn more about what we talked about today and what the city of Seattle has turned into, you can go to our website and put the word Seattle in the search bar, and you will find the ultimate City of Seattle quiz. You can do that and a whole lot more at our website, which is howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
This episode of Stuff You Missed in History Class is brought to you by JackThreads.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Hey, everyone. This is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets in the car, while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.